Welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside Baseball Prospectus' local site covering the Chicago White Sox. You can find this podcast on iTunes by searching for the Catbird Speaks. I'm Colin Whitchurch, joined as always by Nick Schaefer. What's up, Nick?
Good afternoon, Colin. How are you doing?
Good, and we do have a special guest today, a returning guest, long lost, if we thought we lost her. Former BP Southside contributor, now covering the White Sox for their flagship radio station, WLS. It's the baseball girl, Kat Garcia. What's up, Kat?
You guys thought you lost me like the Cardinals lost the rally cat last night?
Yes, it is exactly that.
Yeah, and I imagine if a member of like the Cardinals ground crew tried to pick you up, he would still get, you know, clawed and bitten like the guy did last night.
Yes.
And this would be, yes. It would be even worse because Kat's a secret Cubs fan, so Cardinals, she would be. She had to get that out of the way.
You just said that, Colin.
Right off the bat. Drop that in there.
Yeah, we blow up the deepest, darkest secrets of all our guests. That's why no one ever comes back.
It's true. So we are, what has it been, about 3 weeks since we last recorded, Nick?
Something like that. I was out in Colorado to be the best man in my best man's wedding, and it was delightful.
You've had a wedding like every 2 weeks for the entirety of 2017, it feels like, including your own.
Yeah, Nick.
I think it was mostly my own getting disproportionate airtime, but September, I think I have three.
Jeez,
I don't know. How do you know this many people, much less this many people getting married?
I think it's a matter of Jane's friends are a little older than I am, so, and they're getting married a little later, so I think everything's kind of hitting at once.
Yeah.
I went through that spell maybe 2 or 3 years ago where it seemed like it was like at least once a month. Once I moved away, I started having to say no. I'm like having to judge like how much do I like this friend to where I'm going to spend X amount of money on a plane ticket to go to their wedding.
Yeah, I mean, I had one coworker be a bridesmaid in 12 weddings 1 year.
Holy, no way.
Yeah.
Paid for that or what?
Yeah, right, that's the thing. It'll bankrupt you.
That is the ultimate always a bridesmaid, never a bride. Like, is that girl married?
No, I don't think she's even married. But I guess that means she didn't have to pay for, like, a plus one or anything. Speaking of attractive people.
what a great transition.
Kat wrote an article about Nikki Delmonico. So I think that transition captures author and subject here.
I was going to say, who are you talking about there, Nick or me?
It's comprehensive. And you mentioned Willie Garcia. You know, he's a babe too. If you search, go to WLSAM.com and look up August 10th, Kat Garcia's got her feature on Nikki Delmonico. Kat, without giving away the whole article, is there anything in particular that jumped out at you from while constructing this piece?
I think one of the things that did jump out at me immediately when speaking to Delmonico is just his demeanor. He's so calm. He knows what he's doing. He's only been in the majors for this will be his 9th game tonight. And he already seems like he has been playing this game forever.
It does seem like everyone always talks about kind of the tangible and intangible things that certain players have, especially when they're coming up, making their debut, obviously with the nerves and stuff like that. But that does seem to matter quite a bit. It's like you can say that a guy seems calm on the surface, but like if they're really calm and confident and like not in a cocky way, but just like sure of themselves, then I'm sure that it makes that transition from AAA to the majors a lot easier. And obviously small sample size, but like he's shown that like he's not like afraid to face, you know, the reigning Cy Young winner who he hit a home run off of or anything like that. Is that like kind of the impression you got?
It is. He does mention that he's just not reading into things too much. He's trying not to panic. He's just doing what he does at the plate, which, you know, as we've seen last night, he went 3 for 4. he really battled through a lot of those at-bats. In his first one, he came back from a two-strike count to, you know, I mean, it's just incredible that what we're seeing from him so quickly is what is the most shocking to me.
It is interesting with a player like him to, like, he's never been – he was kind of a fringe prospect when he first came up, drafted by Baltimore. But he's never – even before the White Sox made all these trades, he was never a guy who you'd see, like – in the top 30 lists in the organization. And that's saying something considering that a year ago the organization wasn't very good. But, like, you know, we're not talking about Nicky Delmonico being someone who's going to, you know, has the star potential of so many of the other young prospects we're going to see come up. But if the White Sox find these kind of diamonds in the rough types like Delmonico or like Nick, like you wrote this morning, like an Adam Engel, that is very meaningful in a rebuild.
Right, especially for Delmonico as a left-handed hitter, that could be really valuable going forward.
I think I know that Delmonico's dad was the head baseball coach at Tennessee for like 20 years or something like that. Yeah. So that could help explain his sort of perspective and calmness, and even maybe his willingness to do something cute. Like, he's already got two bunt singles against the shift, which I think is hilarious. And probably like a good strategic thing to do, because he's a guy who's going to have to get by on, I think his contact skills are sort of his biggest strength. But yeah, I think if you look at, certainly for an organization like the White Sox, you look at the, 8 years of failed attempts at contention. A lot of the similarities on those rosters was that they were trying to have the top half of the roster really carry a completely depleted and terrible back half of the roster. So that even 2012, which is the last good White Sox team in that period, was giving key plate appearances and playing time to guys like Ray Almedo, who were like sub replacement, and giving. So, like, and Connor Gillespie, for example, was like their starting third baseman, was like they were relying on him to be a big producer. Instead, you've got a guy like Delmonico. I don't know if Gillespie's the worst comp there, except that Delmonico can play more positions than he can. If you have that guy is sort of plan B or plan C instead of your starter, and if you have a lot of guys like that, you know, okay, you know, we're not counting on Matt Davidson alone because we have Davidson and Delmonico as our sort of backup corner infielder, and we'll see how things shape up. We're not counting on just Yolmer Sanchez because we, as the utility infielder, starting second baseman, because we have him and Saladino and Leary. So
and Alan Hansen.
Yeah, so it's this like redundancy where if Engel is your fifth or even sixth outfielder, he's already better than, say, J.B. Shuck, who was the fourth outfielder on a team that was theoretically trying to make the playoffs. So,
and you didn't even bring up Jerry Sands yet.
No. So if we're raising you're raising the floor considerably at a lot of positions, and if you have a lot of these guys, you give yourself that much of insurance for when, you know, guys who don't have a lot of margin for error might let you down, so you might need to turn to the next one.
Right, absolutely. Then you don't have to worry about playing these guys every day also.
What did did you talk to either Nicky or Ricky about where they're most comfortable playing him? We mentioned he can kind of handle both corners of the infield and the outfield. I don't know if he's considered – if he's a liability at any of them. I know when I spoke to him in spring training, he said that he was most comfortable at third base, and the White Sox said that they were kind of trying to get him accustomed to the outfield. So what did anyone say about that?
It seems like third base is off the table right now. No one's really mentioning it. Everyone seems pretty set on him being in the outfield. And Delmonico seems really like he's going to be trying super hard to get his reps in. He says he goes out and he does early work every day before the games, trying to get familiar with left field. He said he's still in touch with Aaron Rowan. He calls him, texts him for advice, and that he really accredits him to, you know, learning how to play. He did mention that when he was in Charlotte and they put him in left field, he immediately called Aaron Rowan and said, hey, you got to get out here and help me. And so I think that we need to give him a little bit of a break right now and just kind of see where he goes with that, considering this is a completely new position for him.
Sure.
Yeah, and you can kind of see it sometimes. I mean, there's a few he's taken a few routes that sort of indicate that he's still feeling things through, and he's made a couple of mistakes out there. But he is, I think, pretty new to playing that position. And it's what struck me about your piece is how much coaching he's sort of seeking out and crediting with whatever success he's been having. Rowand, and I saw that you brought up Mike Gallinger. This is his second time discussing him on the podcast.
Yeah.
Did you get to talk to him, or I guess he's probably not in Chicago, right?
No, but Delmonico did bring up that he is one of the people who really helped him kind of maintain that patient approach and pick out his pitches. Delmonico has been saying that he's trying to look to those higher pitches and kind of go to the middle of the field. And he really, really seemed like Gallinger was someone who helped him a lot in the off season with that.
And you point out, and this is kind of, it's been kind of fun watching him and Moncada together, because you pointed out that so far Delmonico is successfully attacking pitches in the zone, but really holding off from chasing anything outside the zone. And, you know, that sounds, it's a little facile to say, well, that's all you have to do. But if you can pull that off, it's probably going to help you maximize whatever potential you do have at the plate.
Right. If you look at the zone map that I included in that piece, you would never imagine that this was a guy who's just been in the majors for just a little over a week now. I mean, that's a very, very tailored, I mean, everything he's hitting is in the zone. He has a little problem with, I think it was like going lower outside. But otherwise, I mean, it really looks incredible. He's not swinging all over the place. He has a very planned approach when he goes up to that plate.
And I guess that kind of provides us with a good transition into, you talked about patience and you brought up Moncada. We go from a prospect who was completely unheralded in Delmonico to one who's probably been the most heralded of any White Sox prospect ever in Moncada, who's 18 games into his career, or his White Sox career rather, with a really fun small sample size slash line of 196, 366, 321. He's got 13 walks now in 71 plate appearances. I think I saw a Chris Kamka tweet the other day that since, and this was when he was still at 11 walks, that since Moncada's promotion, he had 11 walks. And the next highest on the team was Abreu with 5. So he's, you know, he's still striking out a ton, which is expected, but he's not swinging pitches outside of the strike zone. And I feel like that patience is something that is a really good sign, regardless of you know, the results of when he actually makes contact so far.
Yeah, Ricky actually brought up last night post-game that he's extremely happy with both Moncada and Delmonico's approach. And for Moncada, he mentioned that, you know, if he can just keep this up, he's really going to have success. This is a solid foundation for him to build off of. And I think it was Ryan actually tweeted earlier today that Moncada's swinging strike rate is 12%, which is down from when he was in Boston and it was 17%. So that right there is an improvement.
Yeah, it's really exciting to see. I know that it'd been mentioned, oh yeah, he has a good eye or whatever, was mentioned in when he was coming up. But when you, at least so far in the pros, he's been extremely patient. I think he's starting to get more comfortable attacking a pitch earlier in the count than he was before. Maybe he was just sort of trying to feel things out at first, and he's being willing to attack a little bit more lately. But, you know, some of those strikeouts are he's really willing to take close pitches, and he's been rung up a couple times looking on pitches that I thought were out of the zone that were really, really close. So the fact that he has the confidence to do that indicates to me that he's got a very discerning approach at the plate, and that he's feeling a lot more comfortable than he was in the past. And, you know, a couple of those strikeouts came when he essentially was asked to spot the pitcher an 0-2 count on some bunt attempts. But it's funny because Moncada's was when you heard the hype, like Colin alluded to earlier, it was always, this is a guy who's got crazy athleticism. And it's true. He's, you know, just dripping with like strength and speed and all that, all those good things. But his eye is really what's like stood out to me in the first couple weeks in the majors for him.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Absolutely.
And I think it's interesting too, like, if you compare, so we're, he's obviously, I mean, he's almost quadrupled the amount of plate appearances he saw during his abbreviated time in Boston last year. But, like, I think that one of the things that is probably difficult for a young player who's trying to come up and, like, hit the ground running, you know, when you get promoted to the majors, is that he's comfortable taking strikes, which you mentioned, Nick, but, like, it's easy to discern from, like, I took this pitch because I didn't think it was a strike, and I took this pitch because even though it might be a strike, it's not something that I knew I could drive, and I'm going to wait for my pitch. And I think right now what he's figuring out is that is what pitches – this sounds so simplistic, but what pitches he wants to swing at, regardless of if it's a strike or not. You know, he's facing such a high level of competition from a pitching perspective that, like, you want to – find your comfort zone of what you know you can drive, what you know when you put the bat on the ball is something's going to happen with it. And even though his batting average isn't there, I mean, he's hitting the crap out of the ball. I mean, just yesterday, I think he had the two walks and he had the double, and I think the one time he didn't reach base, he drove a pitch to the warning track or thereabouts.
Yeah, he did.
It just seems, and even, you know, that first week when he came up, he's just hitting the hell out of the ball. So the fact that the patience is there and that the eye for the plate is there, in addition to, like, I'm not worried about the results as far as the batted balls right now. Like, that's very second nature at this point.
Right. It's still extremely early for anyone to be picking nits right now. I mean, I think we've seen an incredible, incredible display from him so far.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to continue with like an 18% walk rate, but you know, I also expect him to have a better than, I think his BABIP right now is about 300, and again, small sample and all that, but with his speed, I'd expect that to be a little bit higher. I think 300 is about league average. It's been a while since I've really looked at this sort of thing. Actually, should be a little higher now that I think of it. But anyway,
320, I believe.
320, yeah, okay. So 300 feels low for a guy as fast as Moncada is, but yeah, I think it's encouraging so far what I've seen. Do you guys? So if you don't have a minimum of plate appearances on while sorting it, Moncada and Delmonico are currently second and third on the team in on base percentage. I don't think you guys will ever guess number one with minimum plate appearances of zero.
Hang on, wait a minute. Minimum plate appearances of zero. Oh, so is it like Derek Holland or something?
It's Derek Holland.
Hey.
Oh my God.
Because he's one for one on the season.
Hell so, yeah. I was like, okay, wait, zero. Okay, it's got to be. I was like, first my thought was, is there someone who like came up for a day and then got sent back down? I was like, no, it's got to be a pitcher.
Good for you on grabbing the right pitcher on your first try.
Hell yeah. So we've talked Delmonico, we've talked Moncada, unless either of you have anything specific to add on them. There is a third interesting young piece who will be making his MLB debut tomorrow. Finally, long-awaited, not his MLB debut, I guess, his White Sox debut, because he did start for the Nationals down the stretch last season. Reynaldo Lopez, coming up for his White Sox debut Friday against the Royals. We talked, Nick and I, we talked extensively about Lopez, I don't know, about a month and a half ago with Craig Goldstein, the BP minor league editor. You know, our prospect team seems pretty confident, or at least they did at the time, that he was going to be a reliever long term. Obviously, it makes sense that the White Sox are going to give him every opportunity to start until he proves he can't. So I guess open-ended, what are you guys looking forward to or expecting out of Lopez for his debut?
I'm not expecting a whole lot because, I mean, it is his first time in the majors in quite a while. And if I remember correctly, he didn't exactly have success when he came up with the Nationals. I know he's a completely different pitcher than he was back then. He's improved a lot, but it's always best to set your expectations low and go from there.
I know that I think last year with the Nationals, like you said, this is last year. I think he had like some really good games and some really bad ones.
I think it was a mix like that.
Yeah,
like
he destroyed
the Braves twice in a row, which, you know, is basically, I think at the time was basically like destroying the AAA team a couple of times. So, you know, good for him.
He actually pitched more than I thought he did. He made 11 appearances, 6 starts. And yeah, big mixed bag. I mean, he faced the Dodgers in his debut and gave up 6 runs in 4 2/3. He had he had back-to-back starts against the Braves where he went 7 innings in both of them and only allowed 1 run. The first of those starts, he struck out 2. The second of those starts, he struck out 11. So,
yeah.
But after, yeah, I mean, his last 6 starts of the year, he didn't – well, I guess he was in relief then, but he was striking dudes out and I don't know. What were you going to say, Nick?
I guess is he facing the Royals for his debut?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm a little anxious about that. I feel like that's a lineup that could be a little bit more frustrating for a guy who relies on trying to throw it by people. I know the Royals have changed a little bit, but you know, adding a Melky Cabrera to that lineup is another guy who's tough to strike out. He is putting the ball in play, and Ronaldo Lopez is a guy who, when he's at his best, is just like missing bats like crazy. So it may not be the easiest matchup in that sense, although on the whole, it's not the scariest lineup. So it's going to be a test in a way of showing, you know, do the White Sox ability to get the most out of pitchers that might be doubted by other organizations is going to be another data point there. But it's going to be fun. I mean, right now, you know, for months, the rotation, especially since Quintana has been gone, the rotation's been, you know, Rodon's a guy where you watch to see what he can do down the road and watch him for improvements. And Miguel Gonzalez to an extent, and Holland, maybe even to an extent, you're saying, hey, can these guys rattle off a few good starts and maybe make themselves desirable for a waiver wire trade, even for, you know, a really fringy piece. But, you know, you've got a lot of guys in the rotation where, you know, Pelfrey and Shields, and for a while it was like Holmberg, and these guys who are just really placeholders, and they were soldiering along as best they could. But that's such a different viewing experience from Ronaldo Lopez, where you can actually, it's worth paying close attention to the innings where the White Sox are pitching as well, and not just, you know, tuning in only when Moncada's and Delmonico or whatever are about to come up. So I think from a fan's perspective, just having another guy in the rotation where there's a purpose beyond just getting through is going to be a really fun addition.
Right, absolutely. I think for this team, you know, a lot of people say it's hard for me to watch the White Sox continue to lose, and I'm like, but there's so much to watch when they're losing still. I mean, yeah, you have to look at these players individually and what these losses represent, the way they're losing, you know, the things that are progressing. You know, it's not just watching a loss. There's no light at the end of the tunnel. And that's exactly what you're saying with Lopez now, is even if the Sox continue to lose, there's so much to keep your eyes on right now.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that people say that, like, oh, I'm so sick of watching the White Sox lose. Like, have you watched the team for the last 8 years? Like, I would much rather watch this losing team that has a bunch of interesting young pieces than a team
than watch 2013 or whatever that year was that was just,
yeah, the 99 loss season. It's like, yeah, sure, there were still like Sailing Quintana and whatever, but like
that was about it.
You were just watching all these old miserable veterans that were just going through the motions. It's like, at least there's some young exciting guys on this losing team. If you're picking, you know, the lesser of two evils, I would much rather watch the losing team that has these guys who are like fighting for something than the guys who are just, you know, have mailed it in, which we've seen quite a bit of over the last 8 years.
Or even regardless of speculating about, like, you know, where their emotions were. But I know exactly what you mean, like playing out the string as a veteran versus, like, you know, even if even on a night where let's say there's a night where Moncada goes 2-for-3 with a walk, but Mike Pelfrey gets shelled and they lose like 8-2. My takeaway from that is not – like Mike Pelfrey isn't going to be there when they're trying to be good again.
I don't give a shit how Mike Pelfrey pitches.
Like, you know, bless Mike Pelfrey's heart for like still trying as hard as he can to stay in the majors and be effective with, when, you know, the deck is stacked against him. Like, you know, I'm not trying to slam Mike Pelfrey, but he's an older pitcher whose ceiling is extremely limited, and he's just there to get them through this season. So – you know, I'm not watching the game to see how Mike Pelfrey does. I'm not there to, you know, to see, oh, is Mike Pelfrey going to out-duel, like, freaking Chris Sale? Like, I'm not there to watch that. I'm there to watch. And like you said, it was – I was never – if you, and you can go back and sort of read what I've been writing over the years, too. Since about – even 2012, I was really not confident that they had enough arrows in the quiver to make it into the playoffs that year. Like, they were always banking on dumb luck over the last few seasons, and that was pretty when it didn't work out, there was kind of an I told you so feeling to it, which was not fun. And there was also an element of we're wasting Quintana and Sale. Like, this is right. And that's so miserable. Like, how many games did one of those two guys pitch brilliantly and they lost anyway? Like, that was so absurdly frustrating. Whereas now, like, There's a purpose to what's happening.
Right.
If I had a dollar for every time during the Ventura era, we would get a message from Nick that was just, I'm so done with this team.
No, I was going to say, all of this is coming from Nick.
Right?
Well, it was the same. Yeah, 2013 was a little bit different, and 2014 was a little bit different in that, like, 1 year was – the team definitively exploding, and then the next year you got like Jose Abreu, which is really fun. But like, other than some rearranging some of the particulars, it was the same movie over and over again. It was a terrible movie. I hated it.
It was a terrible movie. But I guess so we're recording this on August 10th. We have Lopez making his debut tomorrow on the 11th. He's going to be really interesting to watch down the stretch, especially from the standpoint of just because he's so – is he a starter or not is such an interesting and important question. That's what's going
– flamethrower dudes are fun too. Like, he's going to throw high 90s and he's going to have like a big breaking ball. And whether he has any clue of where it's going, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. So is this it for 2017, though, do you think? I know we have September call-ups. Is there anyone else that you envision joining the team other than just kind of the roster fillery-ish September guys? Do you think they give Giolito a few starts down the stretch? Anyone else come to mind?
Kat, did you want to – I'd defer to you if you want to take a stab at this real quick, or –
I mean, maybe Giolito. Honestly, I'm not sure. There's no one that really sticks out at this point to me.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see what they do with Giolito. I don't know. He's thrown about as many innings this year as he did last year. So I don't know where he'll be in about 3 weeks. But they might want to get him a little more work in if they're hoping that he – I assume they're hoping he's in the rotation at some point next year.
Yeah.
Down at AAA, I think like – he's more of the class of like Delmonico or Engel type players, but you know, you might see Jake Peter,
who's Dan been Hayes.
CSN's favorite, Danny Hayes. But hasn't Jake, I mean, Jake Peter's been, he's a middle infielder. I think he's a second baseman primarily, sort of, what was he? Yeah. Seventh round pick.
Another left-handed bat. He's only been at Charlotte for a little bit. He spent most of the season in Birmingham.
Yeah, he did pretty well in Birmingham, and I think since he's been called up to AAA, he's been killing the ball.
He has. He has as many home runs in 72 AAA at bats as he did in 285 AA at bats.
Wow.
The White Sox very recently claimed off of waivers. The waivers are, yeah, I think so. The Mariners 2013 first round pick, DJ Peterson. They might just let him, they might see where he's at the end of August and then say, hey, you know, take the winter, clear your head, get in shape, and we'll see you in spring training. But, you know, he's a guy who's gotten some, he's been at AAA for, I think, a couple of years now, or at least high minors. He's someone you might see just so they can get some evaluation on him further. But again, that's another, you know, even though he was like a 12th pick overall, he got DFA'd by the Mariners.
It's not unlike their claim on he never had quite the same prospect shine as Peterson, but last year around the same time, I feel like they claimed Rob Refsnyder from the, or was it him from the Yankees? Some failed Yankees prospect they claimed last year, and he just ended up with a different organization after the season was over.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that.
Casey Gillespie might be another guy you see.
Oh, yeah.
So Gillespie and Peterson are both kind of similar in that they're like former first-round picks who, pretty limited defensive value, who have been top 100 prospects from one point or another. So and they're still in their 20s, so it's not hopeless.
Maybe we'll see Jacob May again in September.
Yeah. Tyler Danish, I guess, although he's pitched poorly of late. Might come back. I don't know. There isn't too much left in AAA. Birdie would have been an obvious guy. I mean, you might have already seen him up if he hadn't gotten Tommy John. Yeah. Unfortunately,
they did load. Yeah. They have definitely loaded up on veteran roster filler in Charlotte, which I think is just kind of gearing up for the stretch run and. Assuming injuries and fatigue and everything, they've sitting there now. They have Al Albuquerque and Danny Farquhar and Mark Lowe and Gene Machi. You know, they're to go along with the Chris Volsteads of the world. So I think that they did that, you know, just kind of with the understanding that, like, you know, our cupboard as far as guys we want to pitch in the majors this year is kind of bare. You know, they still have, you know, Yano was down there. He's hurt. They've got Matt Perk, who has some major league experience. Dylan Covey's rehabbing down there. So I think we're going to see more of those type guys than anyone who's going to be interesting and looking toward the future.
Yeah. You know, Jake Peter could be a bench bat. And he's, like I said, it's the Adam Engel sort of situation where you're looking to see if you have a major leaguer or, you know, a sub replacement type guy in the future. But, you know, maybe having that many guys, that many options with major experience, like you said, like Al Albuquerque and the like, maybe that makes you feel a little more comfortable parting with a Miguel Gonzalez in a waiver trade if somebody's interested.
Because yeah, for sure.
You can just throw, especially once the roster expands in September, you know, you can just throw bullpen games, basically. It's like, all right, Perk's going three and Volstead's going three, and that's today. And, you know, it's going to be ugly. It's going to be really ugly.
And we didn't even bring up Carson Falmer, who I know has been terrible, but I guess maybe we could see him in September.
Yeah, I guess that's a safe way to bring him out of the pen without necessarily conceding that he's not a starter yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Tim Anderson.
So Tim has been great lately since he almost punched Marcus Stroman in the face.
Yay.
He didn't actually almost do that, but since that little interesting dust up, he's been on a little bit of a tear lately, which it's great to see. You know, I wrote about Tim last week, kind of giving him a mulligan on the season, I felt like was fair to do. And I was kind of torn while kind of thinking about and writing and researching that piece, because it's easy for us to say, like, we're all rooting so hard for Tim Anderson to succeed that it's easy for us to kind of say, well, okay, you know, he's dealing with his first full season and making all this money and his best friend was killed, which is not something that I would ever want to gloss over in any way. But, you know, it's still easy to have this little tick in the back of my head that says, you know, like, what if he just kind of isn't very good? Is there any worry from either of you about that? Or is it just kind of still like, let's just close our eyes and plug our ears and reset in 2018 and see what we have from him then.
No, I think there's always going to be some sort of trepidation when you don't see those immediate results, regardless of what's going on in his life. I agree. We should chalk this season up as, you know, just don't focus on it. Start over in 2018. But that doesn't mean that I'm not going to go into 2018 a little concerned. That's just where I'm at this point.
Yeah, I think I'm willing to, especially on the defensive side of the ball, you know, I still don't see why he can't be a good 2+ defensive shortstop. Like, he's got all the tools for it. And I know that tools aren't everything, but I'm still pretty optimistic on that. But, you know, you're talking about a guy who's got a career strikeout to walk ratio of 230 to 23. Like, basically, like, literally, his career strikeout to walk ratio is what Chris Sale is doing this year. Like, it's insane. And that, you know, as much as I, you know, that's always going to be part of his profile. He swings a lot. He strikes out a lot. He's not going to walk a ton. Fortunately, he's got enough power and speed that, like, when he does put the ball in play, you should be able to get a lot of, he should be able to make up a lot of that value. And if his glove is good at short, he doesn't need to hit a whole lot to be a valuable player. But it is, like, you'd be crazy not to be a little worried about that. I mean, if he could get it closer to, like, 5-1, where it's like the Adam Jones territory instead of this 10-1 nonsense, then I think that's a lot. That gives you a lot more margin for error.
Definitely. Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess the thing with Anderson is, and the thing with, I mean, even with, I guess with Lurie and Yolmer showing a little bit more with the bat this year, you have fallback options if he really just busts super hard. But Anderson's still got the potential to be, you know, a borderline all-star player. And I think you got to keep chasing it. So
I do think it's interesting, yeah, that last point you kind of threw in there. I feel like I remember writing last year when they announced the Anderson promotion about how, you know, he's like one of the most important prospects of recent memory for the White Sox. You know, if he fails, then it's going to be considered a massive screw up for the organization. And while that is still true to a certain extent, as hyperbolic as it may be, all of the trades that they've made do mean that if Anderson fails, it's less harmful because they've got other options. They might not have other shortstop options right this second, but he's not as critical to the 2019 or 2020 White Sox as he was a year ago, if that makes any sense.
Right, because even when that was the case, I was thinking if this is the best player that system can produce, that's a lot of pressure on his shoulders. I mean, thinking that he's one of the best players to come out of this organization is much more realistic of him, I think.
Well, I mean, this is also a guy who, yeah, he was drafted out of junior college, but I'm sure you guys have heard this before. He was a basketball player. He came to baseball later.
Right.
They blitzed him through the minors so fast. And some of that was simply because, and Han has sort of spoken about this generally. I can't remember if he's pointed to Anderson and said this happened with him specifically, but they raced him to the majors to try to plug a hole on the major league roster. And it was sort of amazing that he hit as well as he did last year.
Yeah.
And it speaks to his crazy athleticism that he was able to hold his own at all.
He was almost a three-win player.
Yeah, and this might be just sort of the price you pay, where he's going to be burning service time in the majors and learning these things in the majors, and that's harder to do. They extended him, so, you know, whatever about service time at this point. But, like, this is a guy who, if you were in a normal organization and you weren't, you know, panicking and trying to throw whatever you can at the problem you're having, then he probably wouldn't have been called up until at least last September, and maybe not even until the middle of this year. which would have given him another 400 or 500 plate appearances at AAA, which, you know, he didn't dominate the minors.
Yeah, he was his best good.
His best single season OPS in the minors was 809.
Yeah.
So
this is kind of not a surprise either.
Yeah, and he has been better of late, like we said. I think since that incident with Toronto, you know, he hit another homer last night. I don't know.
Didn't he have like 3 RBIs last night?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what the numbers are of like the last 7 days or whatever, but he has been.
I had it in my piece today. It's like 355 because he hasn't walked, and then like 700 something.
Yeah, so even if you go back to like July 31st, so the last 9 games, he's at 308, 508, 590, 13 strikeouts, 0 walks. But yeah, the 2 homers, a triple, 3 doubles. So obviously, I mean, the talent's still there. That's the thing, I think. Aside from all the personal issues he's gone through, I think that's what kind of makes me feel so much better about him still kind of turning it around and living up to his potential, is that you still see flashes of that talent. You see all the reasons why the White Sox were so high on him, why he was a top 100 guy, et cetera, et cetera. You just are seeing it in flashes this year instead of seeing it consistently across the board.
Oh, I assume that was... Ooh, is that Cat or Colin?
It definitely wasn't Colin.
I do think, like, if there's a real positive that I could point to from this season, it's that the power that he showed last year looks very real.
Yes.
Yeah, he does. Definitely.
He looks like a guy who, especially if he's going a little bit better, I mean, this is him going poorly, it is a guy who could hit 15 to 20 homers a year, which for, if he, like I said, if he plays to his potential on defense, then that's a, he doesn't have to do much else. He's still stealing bases very efficiently.
Look, he just doesn't get to do it
very much because he's never on base.
I'm not worried, but I'm on guard. Let's just say that.
That's a perfect way of putting it.
But I'm watching.
Yeah.
I'm watching him.
Yeah. And 2018 will be an important year for him. I think, you know, playing a premium defensive position like he does, it's like, you know, he's been bad defensively this year, but that is the stuff that I'm least concerned about, because that is the stuff that seems the most mental, is the fielding. You know, just like simple stuff like setting your feet before you throw, or just having that focus. You know, he has he's played almost the exact same amount of innings at shortstop this year as he did last year now. In fact, just 2/3 of an inning off, approximately the same amount of chances, and he's committed 8 more errors. You know, I don't have like his UZR or anything like that, or his FRAA in front of me, but I know that he, you know, he's always passed the eye test from a fielding perspective, and I feel like his range is really good. It's just kind of the mental aspect that he needs to get down. And even if his bat doesn't ever reach full potential where he's like putting up a 800 OPS every year or whatever, as long as he reaches that potential with the glove, he's still going to be a valuable player. And again, with all of the potential talent that the White Sox have coming down the road, he doesn't need to be a top or middle of the order bat anymore. He just needs to be a good glove and a competent bat to be valuable for the White Sox down the road, and even to justify the contract that he signed, because it's not like that was a bank breaker either.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting about the rebuild is, A, is you have so many more options, right? Like, it used to be you'd be following the 1 or 2 decent prospects in the system, and you'd be checking in if they went 0 for 4 on the night. It's like, oh, well, that's the whole minor league system for today. That's a bummer. Yeah. As opposed to, it's like, oh, well, Zach Birdie got TJ. It's, well, you know, that's a shame. You know, wish him a speedy recovery. We'll see him in 2019. And there's like a dozen other arms that I'm interested in on a day-to-day basis, or if not more. Right. I think off the top of my head, I can think of like 15 guys who I think have like very real major league potential. And, you know, you're no longer saying Tim Anderson needs to be like Francisco Lindor for this team to be successful. If he's like, I don't know, the like Alcides Escobar when he was going well sort of thing.
Yeah.
That'd be fine, because now you're envisioning the offense being built around Moncada and Eloy instead of it be, you know, like those two guys could be, you know, middle of the order type hitters, and Anderson, instead of you needing him to be your like best or second best position player going forward, he could be like your fourth or fifth or sixth, and you'd be fine.
Did you bring up Lindor specifically because Kat thought he was going to suck?
Okay, are we still talking about that?
Okay, in Kat's defense, this was like 2 years ago. We were talking about, I think, Lindor, Correa, and Seager. And I think relative to that competition, Kat said something like, oh, Lindor can't hit.
Also, you know my bias towards the Indians.
Hmm.
You have a bias toward too many teams. It's hard to keep track of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically, I just hate everyone unless I say different.
You
automatically assume I hate everyone.
You love the Rangers, right?
The shorthand is Kat said that Lindor can't hit. So
yeah, and although to be fair, he has probably had the third best season of those three guys this year.
Well, I mean, the thing is, Lindor is going to be a Gold Glove shortstop for like 15 years, and Correa is probably going to be a third baseman, and Seager might be too, and
that's
like,
true.
What, 3 or 4 years?
So I guess long story short is that Kat was wrong.
Oh, yep. God, the first time anyone's ever been wrong.
Especially about evaluating a 21-year-old baseball player.
Yeah.
And you weren't really wrong. I mean, Seager and Correa are still probably better hitters.
Right. So, moral of the story, Kat is never really wrong.
And, you know, and this is actually a good, you know, as much as I like FRAA better than UZR, for example, you know, FRAA thinks that Lindor has been a below average defensive shortstop this year. And maybe he has been, but, you know, it's not everything. So, you know, even if you see some red on Tim Anderson's FRAA, like, if I feel like if you watch a lot of baseball, and the defensive metrics wildly differ from your from the eye test, then, you know, maybe take the stats with a grain of salt and trust yourself a little bit.
Although, yeah, I'm definitely still really Yankee big fan on the eye test over the stats.
If you're a Yankee fan talking about Derek Jeter, none of this applies. I think we have Kat for another just under 10 minutes. I kind of like closing these with some, you know, looking at the league as a whole a little bit. I don't know if you have any more White Sox specific stuff that you guys wanted to get to. Oh, Aaron Bummer seems cool. I don't know. Like, like the wild card races and the NL Central race getting pretty interesting. I don't know, Kat. I mean, given that the Cubs are. Are Cubs and White Sox for you, is it like 1 and 1A, or is there a 1-2, or are they just tied? Like, I don't know.
No, it's definitely 1 and 1A.
Okay.
Which one's 1A?
Back there.
Which one's 1A?
The Cubs.
Okay.
So the Cubs are only a game and a half up on both Milwaukee and St. Louis. What are your predictions for that division heading down the stretch?
Well,
hell, the Pirates are only 3.5 back.
Huh? I know.
Okay.
Before yesterday at like 3 o'clock, this would have been a very different answer. But right now, I think we need to see what's going on with Wilson Contreras, because he's likely going to be out for a few weeks. And that is not good with Al Avila behind that plate and in that lineup.
Right.
And, I mean, the Brewers are not going away anytime soon, despite what I've been told. They're going to be bad soon. They're going to be bad soon. Nope. They're still not bad. And it's August.
Yeah.
So it is very interesting right now. There's really no telling, I think, until we find out what's going on with Contreras. And also, apparently, the Brewers are interested in Ian Kinsler. I heard something about that.
Huh. I had heard that.
Because he's on waivers, I believe, right now. Revocable waivers.
That's interesting. I mean, right now, I guess they have, what, VR and Sogard for second base?
Yeah, Sogard, since he came back from the DL, has tanked.
Well, and I guess he's, you know, his track record isn't super strong either.
Right, we all knew that little stint he was on was not real.
He's the face of baseball.
Maybe like 4 years ago.
I didn't think VR, you know, what I didn't think last year was what to expect from him moving forward, because last year he was like freaking out, you know. I think he was like what everybody thought Edgar Renteria would be at his peak or something for like forever. But VR, I didn't think he'd be this bad either. I think he's better than a 603 OPS, but if you're scrapping and clawing for every single game you can get, it feels like, yeah, I mean, Kinsler's a pretty clear upgrade there.
They remind me, the Brewers remind me a lot of, like, I was trying to look this up to see if my comparisons are apt. Like, the 2012 Pirates, like, they, I feel like it was either the 2012, that was the year before they broke their playoff drought, and they kind of got off to a hotter start than expected, if memory serves me. Everyone's like, oh, they're kind of a year ahead of schedule. Or it might have even been the 2013 Pirates that did make the playoffs.
No, I think you're right. I think it was 2012 that they were like...
Yeah, and everyone's like, oh, they're, oh shit, they're ahead of schedule. You know, should they buy? Should they buy, I remember, was like the trade deadline. And they didn't really buy. They like made a couple of cheap trades where they didn't give away any prospects of value to kind of plug holes here and there, because it didn't make sense to give up the entire farm in an attempt to make the playoffs, just kind of follow their plan instead. And then, of course, it paid off, because then in 2013 they won 94 games, and in 2014 they won 88, and in 2015 they won 98 games. So it does kind of feel kind of similar, where I think the Brewers are doing the smart thing, where they're trying to plug holes because they're like, hey, holy shit, we're competitive. We didn't expect that. So let's find these cheap ways to kind of stay competitive for the rest of 2017 while also not completely throwing aside this plan that we have with this souped up farm system that's going to help us be competitive for the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
Look, yeah, it doesn't matter what anyone does, because we all know the Dodgers are just going to eat everyone alive. So nothing matters.
I mean, see, the White Sox just won 2 straight games against the Astros. So how can you
see? Oh, God, give them the trophy right now.
No. He's pointing out, like, incorrectly that
the unpredictability.
Like, baseball playoffs are so wacky that if a team as bad as the currently constituted White Sox can, like, annihilate Dallas Keuchel, like, what, you know.
Dallas Keuchel hasn't been that great, though, because he's been broken.
Well, and it's not like he had the most inspiring, like, it wasn't like an arsenal that you wanted to take to the bank. Like, like, the fact that they're relying on Keuchel, McCullers, and Morton is,
I don't know how they're thinking that that's going to work, because it's clearly not.
It could work. It's just, it seems like a very risky proposition.
Because
those guys can be incredibly effective. It's just they're rarely healthy, and, you know, sometimes when they're pitching, they're not pitching at 100% either. But all right, so once you get past the wild card games, there's, what is it, 8 teams? So you roughly assume that each team has, like, oh gosh, how does that work out? It's like a 13% chance if they're all equal. And then you shade it percentage points based on how good you think they are. But, like, I don't know. If the Dodgers and Nationals play a 5-game series, how weird would it be if the Nationals won, like, 3 out of 5? That's not strange.
It's not that strange, I guess. No.
I was looking back at the the last time. So we have two kind of runaway best teams in the Astros and Dodgers. The last time that they're both on pace for more than 100 wins this season. The last time that two teams won 100 games in a season was 2004, when it was the Cardinals and someone. I don't remember. I looked this up last night.
Was it the Yankees?
It might have been the Yankees. Hang on. I can bring this up really, really fast. 2004 it was the Cardinals and Yankees. The Cardinals won 105. The Yankees won 101. And neither team won the World Series.
The Cardinals made it there. The Yankees made it to the ALCS, yeah.
Yeah, correct. And if you look, if you set the threshold at that triple-digit number, which is kind of silly to do, but it's a cutoff point, it's kind of helter-skelter as far as who wins a World Series and who doesn't. You know, the Cubs won the World Series last year, obviously, with 103. The Yankees won the World Series in 2009 with 103. It's happened.
White Sox 105 with 99.
Yeah, 16 teams since 2000 have won 100 games. The only World Series winners out of that are the 09 Yankees and the 16 Cubs. Before that, you want to find the next World Series winner that won 100 games. You go all the way back to the 98 Yankees, who, of course, won 114. So I
fun at.
Yeah.
In Astros World Series facts, the Astros have still yet to win a World Series game as a franchise.
That's true. But I guess the point is, like, I mean, obviously everyone points to the 0-1 Mariners, which is the record that the Dodgers are kind of maybe could hit, the 116 wins. You know, they lost in the ALCS. All of these 100-win seasons haven't been winning the World Series. A lot of them haven't even been making the World Series, because that's just how much of a crapshoot the playoffs is. And that's why, as much as it seems like the Dodgers are just going to destroy everyone, and they very well could, and maybe the Astros will do the same in the American League, it's really fucking tough to tell, and that's what makes the playoff. There's no, it's not like the NBA where we went to the playoffs and everyone said, oh, it's going to be Cavs-Warriors, and then it was Cavs-Warriors. Everyone this year is saying, oh, it's going to be Dodgers and Astros. That doesn't mean it's going to be Dodgers and Astros.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask me to bet on one team, certainly if, I mean, ask me at the beginning of the playoffs and I'll ask you how many of the Astros and Dodgers top pitchers are even healthy.
Yeah.
But the NBA was what, like, those two teams, it was like, maybe the Spurs can do it. And then they, like, injured Kawhi Leonard immediately. And it's like, okay, so they can't. The Dodgers, I think, are better than the Astros. I think some of the NL teams at the top there, like, I like the Nationals a lot. I think, I wouldn't feel great if I were the Astros and I draw like Boston or whatever, because you're gonna get Chris Sale'd a bunch of times and that really sucks. So it's so wide open. And I closed our last episode by asking Colin who was making the wild card game in the American League.
Oh yeah,
and I think we said Tampa and the Yankees at the time. I think we agreed.
Yeah,
seemed most likely at the time. It's pretty chaotic. I don't know, Kat, who are your predictions for the AL wildcard as it stands right now?
I mean, what's going on with the Mariners right now?
They're in the second wildcard spot right now.
That was more of a rhetorical question. But, yeah, I think I'm going to put some money on the Mariners at this point. But then again, like you guys said, 3 weeks ago when you recorded your podcast or whatever, you would have never said the Mariners.
Yeah.
And no. It's only August.
Yeah, I mean, the Mariners top three have three pitchers with more than 100 innings thrown this year. One of them is James Paxton, which, you know, great.
He's been really good.
The other two are Ariel Miranda and Yovani Gallardo. So, you know.
Interesting, yeah.
You know, one of these shitty AL wildcard contenders is going to the World Series. That's just it. Whether it's Seattle or Kansas City or Tampa or fucking Minnesota.
If it's Tampa, I'm quitting.
Dude, I hope it's the Angels.
Oh, the Angels, man. Hell yeah, Mike Trout, playoffs, let's go.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Has he been in the playoffs?
To quote Stained. Yeah, didn't they win like 98 games in like 2012 or something like that?
I don't know.
That was a long time ago. I can't remember that far back.
Let's see, 2012, Trout, that was his first full season, you know, where he should have won MVP anyway. Let's see, 2012, they won 89 games, finished third. Did they make the playoffs with Trout?
I don't think so.
2014, they won 98 games.
Okay, so once.
Feels like a long time ago.
Yeah, the AL wildcard race, though, I feel like there's nobody that – it's a frustrating race to follow because there's nobody in that race, to me, worth rooting for. I guess the Mariners are the closest thing, but it's just really enjoyable to see their torment and also have a team that – has a longer playoff drought than the White Sox. but the Yankees have never really been worth a team I want to root for. And, you know, fuck the Royals and Twins, obviously. I guess the Rays I'm fine with. The Angels I'm fine with.
Orioles would be fun.
Orioles, yeah. So that they cannot use Zach Britton again.
Yeah, and it's silly. Like, it's really silly, like, yeah. The Orioles' persistent success. It's pretty great.
It's insane also to look at, like, well, everyone, you know, Texas is dead. Toronto's dead. Detroit's dead. They're 4, 5, and 6 games out of a wild card spot. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not insurmountable if you look past the fact that all of those teams are well below 500 and really bad at baseball.
Yeah. They're behind so many teams, but like,
yeah.
Coming into the season, I thought the Blue Jays had a pretty good shot. I mean, I guess Sanchez missing so much time and Donaldson missed a bunch of time.
Yeah, all the old guys. Yeah. And I work with a Blue Jays fan, and he said, if you'd told me before the season that like Justin Smoke was going to do what he did and that like Kevin Pillar was going to play like a borderline all-star for half of a season, you'd have been like, hell yeah, we're winning 100-plus games. But the problem ended up being like Tulowitzki's bad, Donaldson couldn't stay healthy, Bautista was bad for half a season, the pitching staff couldn't stay healthy. But all of the question marks on the roster have been great this year. Anyway,
I think Mariners, Rays, Angels, all those would be fine if it's the Twins or Royals.
I feel like TBS disagrees with you.
Yeah, I mean the plus side of the White Sox trading all my favorite players to teams I don't like is it softens the blow when they inevitably win.
Exactly. So. Well, we're Cat probably needs to get going, so maybe we should call it there.
Cat, yeah. Yeah.
Any parting words? You can follow Cat on Twitter at TheBaseballGirl and find her work. WLSAM.com is where you can find her work.
Thanks for having me, guys. This was fun. It's just like old times.
Yeah, I miss you, Kat. Good to have you back.
It's not like we didn't speak, you know, like 20 minutes before this podcast, but okay, Nick.
Yeah, dang, well, and I'll see you in Chicago in about a month.
Yeah.
All right, talk to you guys later.